Welcome to Advancing the Science of Addiction, brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. I'm your host, Jimmy Alexander, and today we have the privilege of speaking to Dr. Betty Jo Salmeron, MD, who is a psychiatrist and staff clinician in the neuroimaging research branch at NIDA IRP. And doctor, thank you so much for joining us today. To start off, doctor, could you please just tell our listeners what NIDA IRP is and what is the role that you perform there?
Sure. Thanks for having me. The NIDA IRP is the National Institute on Drug Abuse's intramural research program. So we're part of the National Institutes of Health, and we are focused on trying to better understand drug abuse problems and try to develop better treatments for them. So my role as a staff clinician, I'm a physician, medically trained. My role is to kind of bring a clinical perspective to the work we do, to the research work we do. So I'm involved in everything from helping to design the research protocols to figuring out how to implement them, with a particular responsibility for making sure that everything is done safely for our participants. And then I also participate in the data analysis and interpretation of the data and writing up of the papers that result from it.
Well, I have to be honest with you, because I'm so impressed. I was reading your bio, and it says that you got a BA in mathematics and economics from Rice University. Now, most people, when you go, what did you really love? I loved math and economics. I mean, I'm no Adam Smith, but I will tell you that's impressive sounding. Now, when did your love for math and equations start?
As a child, I always really enjoyed math, just found it fascinating and really wanted to continue with that. I grew up in an academic household. My dad was a professor at Brown University, and his one recommendation was take math until you get a C.
That's I'm writing that one down. That is a great line. Until you get a C.
Yeah, no, I never got a C, so I ended up with a major in math.
That's impressive. And then you made him even more proud by becoming a doctor.
Well, not exactly, but I did go take that path.
I'm sure he was impressed. I'm sure he told his friends at the coffee shop, you know, my daughter, doctor. So what led you from, you've got the math and economics degree. Because you say, well, you could go to Wall Street, you could, you know, some big Fortune 500 company, but you went into medicine. How did you take that turn?
So that's a kind of interesting story. So actually, my plan was to go on in economics grad school. And so I applied to a couple programs. I got into MIT was about to, to head down that. But I was a little uncomfortable. And the more I thought about it, the more my interests in economics went from the macro level, just how the economy really functions, to the micro level, how people make their decisions. And then it realized that the basic assumption of the economics model, that people make rational decisions, just isn't true. They don't. And so then I started thinking, how should I think about, you know, untying this knot? And that's when I started thinking about, maybe I want to go to med school and get into psychiatry and try to really understand how people actually make the decisions they make. Because unless you define rational decision making in just a total tautology, if that's what you did, then that was the rational choice for you. It's pretty obvious in just casual observations of what people do around you that they're often not making great decisions, including myself. I knew that about myself. I don't always make the most rational decisions. So trying to understand that better kind of led me to shift gears and decide not to pursue the economics went back and got the prerequisites I needed for med school and applied to that and went in that direction instead.
Well, two questions. First, do you do your own taxes? And second, do all your friends, or when they realize what you do for a living, when they first find out what you are and what you have your doctorate in, do they think, are you questioning me? Are you analyzing me as we're sitting here?
I think all psychiatrists get that a little bit. They either get that or how crazy are you that you went into psychiatry? And both are true. So,
Oh, my gosh. And do you do your taxes?
I did for a long time. I finally handed that off to my husband, and I don't know, I might take it back at some point.
So, your day-to-day life at work there. So, you're a psychiatrist, and obviously, you were motivated to help people. And I love how math actually led you to that, to that line of work. And so, now, what is a day like for you at NIDA?
So it's quite variable. Depending on the experiments we're running, I need to be in the building to cover it. Sometimes I need to be there to help out with it. Usually it's stuff I just need to be available by phone for. So then the rest of my time is taken up with kind of, the sort of reading up on what people are doing in the research and reading up on trying to help figure out what the results are that we got that what they might really mean. And then there's also, of course, a lot of committee work
The fun
and a lot
part.
of paperwork. So that's basically it.
Now, would you say that your degree in math has helped you with what you're doing there, with the paperwork?
Absolutely. No, it definitely helps because it helps just to train your mind to think logically about things. And then just having a good math background, the way our research works with the neuroimaging, we gather these huge data sets that are very difficult to manage, and very difficult to figure out how to pull out the patterns that are in there and things. And having a math background lets me at least understand the concepts of what's being used to analyze the data, even if at this point I don't get involved in the nitty-gritty so much. I do understand why the different steps are being taken, and I can point out if something's been done that might actually lead to some erroneous results. So yeah, it's definitely been very helpful. Very, very glad I did keep with my dad's advice and keep taking
Well,
math.
it's like how I felt about my mom telling me to take typing in high school.
No.
Little did I know that how
Yes.
important. That's obviously in a different level. But how did you go from so you graduate and medical school, and I'm reading here, and it's very impressive. You completed your internship at Baylor before a residency at Massachusetts General Hospital, which is affiliated to Harvard. And I hope in the first 5 minutes when you talk to somebody, you bring up that you were affiliated with Harvard, because that's normally
No, I don't.
what happens. So, how did you go from the hospital there in Massachusetts to NIDA? How did that journey take you?
So that was a bit roundabout. I finished the residency at Mass General. Really enjoyed it a lot. Already had one kid that I had in med school, and took a year off when she was born just because I don't multitask along those lines very well. So I took a year off, came back, and completed med school, went into the residency, had a second child during the residency, took a year extra for that, finished up the residency, and had enjoyed my I did some side work in substance abuse and really liked it, and I found it very intriguing because of all of the psychiatric disorders, it's clear that some choices matter in what we do, but there's a lot of genetics also. But substance dependence was really the only one where you have to do something before any vulnerabilities are going to kick in and get addicted. If you can have all the vulnerabilities in the world, if you never touch the substance, you're not going to get addicted. So it has to start with a choice that a person makes, and then the consequences of those choices will unfold in ways that are driven by a lot of different factors. But I just found it to be a very interesting mix of genetic and other sorts of predispositions, but compounded with a choice you have to make to set the whole thing in motion. So I was interested in the substance dependence at that point. But I finished the residency, and it was my husband's turn to find a job because we were going to plan to have a third kid. And so he found a position in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And so we went out there, and all I did was my residency training director knew the residency training director out there and introduced us. So I supervised a couple of residents for him for the first couple of years out there. And at some point, he had lunch with me and said, "Hey, you interested in research?" And I said, "Well, I always thought I was, but I've gotten this far and haven't managed to do any." And he said, "Well, I have a PhD who needs a doc to inject cocaine in the middle of the night. Are you interested?"
Stop. Wow. You don't hear that every
And
day.
This was, it turns out that the Medical College of Wisconsin was one of the places at which the techniques we use with fMRI were developed. Starting with some very basic sorts of things of, tapping fingers and then can you see the motor cortex activate? And we could. And once they got that worked out, the guys who were doing that went around to all of the animal labs and said, "Hey, you want to do what you're doing in the rats in people? We can do it now."
We have to
And
we have to take a break, doctor. We're going to find out how the doctor here got a job injecting people with cocaine. That's next on Advancing the Science of Addiction.
This episode of Advancing the Science of Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
Thank you for spending part of your weekend with us here on Advancing the Science of Addiction. I'm Jimmy Alexander, your host, along with Betty Jo Salmeron, doctor, who just told us about her first job getting into this business by being asked if she could inject people with cocaine. Doctor?
Yeah, so actually, the guy that they introduced me to, Dr. Elliot Stein, he was a rat neurophysiologist, and his research had been giving cocaine to rats and studying various aspects of their response to that. And so with the development of this method of functional magnetic resonance imaging, we were able to move those exact experiments into humans in the magnet. And so the first attempts to use this in humans were very basic things. Let's just see if we can see the effects of the drug on the brain. See if we can see the responses to drug cues while it's actually happening. And so those were actually two of the very first experiments that I got involved with Dr. Stein. And so, yeah, my role was to literally inject cocaine into humans in the middle of the night in the scanner. Middle of the night because it was a clinical scanner. That was the only time researchers had access to it. And we would get bumped off if there was an emergency in the ER that needed the scanner. But otherwise, from Sunday nights till 9 till about 3 in the morning, we had access to the scanner.
Now, it's funny because your line of work now is doing the reverse, making sure people don't do cocaine. Now, with that, were these people who had cocaine addiction problems, or was this?
Yes. Oh, yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So these were, it's been very interesting to get to know folks with these sorts of problems over the years. It's when you just advertise for people with cocaine problems to come in and do a research study, what you typically get is people who have been using for 20, 30 years. They've tried to quit or cut down a number of times. They've tried various treatments. It doesn't work. They have managed to kind of get to a level of some stability where it's still a problem, but they're able to go on with life in some version. And they'll tell you that they were much, much worse when they were younger. And they'll also tell you, you'll never get those people in for studies because they're too scattered all over the place. They're too dysfunctional to participate in research. So we'd get these folks who'd been doing it for a long time, still met criteria for dependence, would have liked to have stopped, but didn't have any hope for themselves from stopping. And their attitude was, yeah, I'd like to participate. You might be able to figure out a way to help other people stop. Yeah, sign me up. I'll do that.
So they know that their addiction, their problem, the proverbial monkey on their back is so bad that they would never be able to stop. But what they're doing is actually, this is so kind, they're work on me for the greater good, so somebody else down the road. And would you say it's true that that if they were younger, you would never have been able to get them in? Have you noticed that with different ages of...
We have tried to target younger populations to get in, and it's been very hard. And then after we were here for a while, we had a focus group with some of the participants that we did have in, who are mostly in their 40s, late 40s, early 50s, something like that. And that's where they just flat out told us, you're not going to get those guys in. They're too wild or too dysfunctional. It's very hard, you know, because our studies are fairly demanding. It's not just asking a few questions, you know, catch somebody on the street and ask them a few questions or something. You have to come in and be evaluated medically to make sure it's safe for us to do whatever we're going to do with you. And you have to be able to, you know, to lie in the scanner for a couple of hours and tolerate that without moving around too much and things. And so it's you know, reasonably demanding. And yeah, their feedback was, I know myself when I was at that phase, there's no way.
And forgive me for my ignorance on cocaine, but the stories you never hear when people who have that addiction, that it's such an unpleasant come down, right? Is that the proper term? I want to make sure. And when you're getting
Yeah,
that,
you mean, you talk about what happens after the high goes away and
yeah,
the
and they
next.
just feel horrible, and I never understand because that's not of all the monkeys on my back, that's not one of them, thank God, but. It just sounds like a miserable existence because you're just trying to waiting to get the next time. And with that these people have lived such a long life with families, with jobs, and with that addiction,
I
that's
mean,
got
sometimes they do lose a
yeah.
lot of those things along the
Well,
way.
or I should say, they're still existing and still walking the earth,
They're
breathing,
still existing, yes.
which has to be. That can't be something that happened. I would imagine a lot of people lose their lives, obviously, using that drug. So the fact that they've made it to the 50s, it's pretty astonishing considering what they've been putting in their bodies for such a long time.
Yeah, and you know, those things do happen a lot. That doesn't happen to everyone who's using. So, you know, when I ask a lot of our participants about, you know, how they feel day after and things, a lot of times they don't report a lot of that sort of dysphoria and things, but that's definitely a real thing. But it just doesn't happen to absolutely everyone.
Well, I do want to get back. So you're in Wisconsin, you're doing this testing, and I would imagine some of the things that you heard from those people so many years ago, if you talk to the people who are in the testing now, they're saying pretty much the same thing. They're saying, I should say, similar things, similar life experiences.
It's
But
similar, yeah.
how did you get from Wisconsin to the area here, to NIDA?
So I mentioned Dr. Elliot Stein, who was the PhD researcher I was working with in Wisconsin. He started disappearing unexplainedly for a few days at a time here and there. And he was actually interviewing for the job here at NIDA. And so when he got that job, he brought two of us, me on the clinical side and another researcher on the analytic side with him. And so the three of us, we were brought here to form the neuroimaging research branch. So that's how I ended up. Came with the team, and we've been working together. You know, Elliot did finally retire about 2 years ago. But yeah, we've been the team for a long, long time.
What year do you remember what year you moved
We
here?
came in 2002.
So a big portion of your life has a huge portion of your life has been to make sure that folks are to help folks understand addiction and
That's
battle
been
it.
the goal, yeah.
That has to mean a lot to you. So that w was there ever a moment in your life where you met somebody that made you think I want to do something about this, or was it strictly from meeting the doctor there and asking you to help with the
I mean,
research?
like I said, but through my clinical training at Mass General, I had done a little extra work and a little side job and things in substance abuse, and I had found that very intriguing. And just the notion of there being a disorder where people really don't want to do what they're doing and they keep doing it anyway. What's that about? That's really a nut to crack. So, that's, I mean, I can't say there's any one person that really triggered the interest. There's not a huge substance dependence problem in my family. It wasn't anything like that, which it often is for people who get interested in this field. It was really for me just, you know, this is a really interesting problem, why people would continue to do something that's they know is harming them a lot and they know is getting in the way of their lives progressing in the ways they would like them to. You know, what how can we find ways to help them with that?
Well, it's interesting, you know, if even if you watch, if you're like me and you watch old TV shows, I don't know how I get addicted to watching Columbo and Cannon and all these old detective shows from the 70s, but I have. And it's funny how they talk about drug issues then. And just, you know, terrible terms for them. And like it's like they're bad people. Like, you know, it's they're dirty, you know, the junkies, all these terrible names, not realizing now, all these years later, we totally wouldn't have to treat somebody like that. I think of them, even the movie Arthur with Dudley Moore, the lovable drunk. And the whole movie was that it was funny because he was drunk. Everything was funny because he was drunk. Now you're like, oh, my God, get that man help. Like, you know, it's funny how society, especially here in the United States, has changed. The ways they look and treat folks with substance issues.
Yeah. I think there has been, you know, that's something that Susan Eldridge here at NIDA has been really working on. We're trying to get more outreach into the community to help reduce the stigma associated with having an addictive problem, because it's still there. I think we have made progress with that. You know, starting with the institute director who hired us, labeled it a brain disease. This, you know, it's a brain disease. You need to treat it like a brain disease, and just trying to really, really get it out there that this is a chronic relapsing disorder, like a whole lot of other chronic relapsing disorders. You wouldn't treat your diabetic for 90 days and then say, done. It's a chronic disorder. If they come off their treatment, they're going to relapse. You know, they will get sick. So we need to really, like I said, I think we've made a lot of progress in viewing this as a chronic disease model, where, you know, there's stuff you do in the acute phase and there's stuff you do in the chronic phase to maintain people.
Well, it's definitely just fascinating during our shows here to learn so much and everything that's going on with NIDA. And as I have said this to probably every guest I spoke to, it's not often that you talk to somebody whose job it is to make the world a better place. And you guys all are doing that. Now, coming up, we have more with Dr. Betty Jo Salamaran, and we'll find out how psychiatry is helping folks with substance abuse issues. And that's coming up on the Advancing the Science of Addiction.
This episode of Advancing the Science of Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
I'm Jimmy Alexander, here with Dr. Betty Jo Salamaran. Now, Doc, you are a clinician at NIDA, and you are all doing research to help really drug addiction and helping people learn some people have addictions and others don't. Now, I know that during the clinical tests, you do it on folks who have issues with cocaine, marijuana, cigarettes,
yep,
and heroin.
I don't personally do any heroin studies at this point. There are other labs in the at the IRP that do.
And with that, is there a difference between somebody who has a problem, let's say, with smoking, and somebody who has an addiction with cocaine?
Yeah, it does seem to involve some common elements, but cigarettes are a bit of a different beast, primarily because the effects are not so impairing. So people routinely smoke and function quite well. And a lot of people will tell you they don't function at work without their cigarettes or their nicotine. Whereas most of the other drugs that people get into trouble with, their work is not going to be so good if they're having three beers at lunch every day. Whereas a cigarette might actually, you know, it does have some cognitive enhancing effects that are real. So yeah, it is a little different. There's also, it's also kind of interesting because the nicotine is probably one of the most addictive, at least in the form of cigarettes. If you compare, how addictive different substances are, just in terms of, the number of people who try it once who go on to be actually dependent on the stuff. Generally, it's in the range of somewhere between 10 and 20%. Heroin might be a little higher. Cigarettes, there's a good meta-analysis out showing that it looks like it's more like two-thirds of the people who ever try a cigarette end up being daily smokers.
Wow.
And most of your daily smokers, 80, 90% of the daily smokers are actually addicted. Every now and then you get, I have run into people who said, yeah, I smoked pack a day for 20 years, and then my doc said my lungs were getting bad, and I stopped the next day and didn't have any trouble. So that person, I would say, yeah, they were doing it because they enjoyed it. They were not really addicted, because that's sort of the definition of addiction, that, doc tells you you have to stop, and you say, okay, I will, and then you can't do it. You just can't walk away from it.
I saw that up close. My mom had strokes due to smoking, and
Yeah.
even in the hospital, if she was begging my sisters, please, take me outside, let me have one, just one. All I need is one,
Just one more. Yes,
just one
just one more.
more. And it's like,
Yes.
oh my gosh, I mean,
Yes.
that's it's heartbreaking. But
I've
with
seen people smoking from the trach,
I see that too.
in hospitals. Yeah, no, it's th those are the people who are really addicted.
Yeah, I worked at a drugstore in high school, and we there gentleman, Mr. Robinson, I still remember his name, and he would smoked Camel non-filters, and he had the tracheotomy in the box, and he would still smoke out of that, and it's like, oh my gosh, but he obviously majorly addicted. Now, have you noticed? I know you do research on marijuana. Have you noticed? Is there more? Do you think more people have the problem now because it's so readily available and legal now?
Yeah, so I don't do a ton of work with
Yeah.
marijuana, but it does, it's probably one of the ones where, if you just thinking over clinical interviews I've had with people over the years, and that is one where you really do find a lot of people reporting, yeah, over the summer I wasn't doing much of anything. I smoked three joints every day. I had a great time. It was time to go back to school. I put it all down and went back to school. And that's not, you don't usually hear a pattern like that with alcohol. If they're drinking that much alcohol, it's going to be hard to cut right back and go to school. If they're doing, heroin, they're going to be physically dependent, and it's really going to be difficult. Or any of the opiates. And same thing with cocaine. You don't hear that sort of a pattern. So, well, it's definitely the case that people can get actually addicted to marijuana. It's probably a little less common that they actually get addicted to that one than to some of the other drugs. With it becoming legal in a lot of places, there probably is a little different mix of people who are trying it now. I believe the experience in Colorado, where it's been there that way for a little longer, has not really shown a huge change in how many people are getting into trouble with it. But don't quote me on
Yeah, no. I,
that.
well, and I know I'm asking you questions that, just curiosity, because I'm sure when you meet people and they tell you and you tell them what you do for a living, I'm sure that you get this, you're asked the same three or four questions over and over, right? When people find out what you do.
Yeah, there are common questions.
Like, what are a couple that you're asked?
Why do people do it? Why does it happen? And we don't really know yet, but we do have some theories. We know that most of the drugs that people get into trouble addiction-wise with do something to the dopamine system. One of the things that, they boost release of dopamine. And, dopamine's kind of got the public perception of the feel-good neurotransmitter. And it's involved in that. But one of the things, it's a little more subtle than that. What it does is kind of triggers whether there's a mismatch between what's expected and what's received. So you take a drug that boosts dopamine once, and that does feel good. And then the next time you go to do it, there's cues associated with doing it, and that sets up an expectation. And what happens with dopamine normally, if I know that if when I put this chocolate in my mouth, I know what it's going to feel like, I know it's going to be pleasant, and then I put it in my mouth, and that's exactly what I experience. Then what happens is you get the dopamine release to seeing the chocolate, and when you actually consume it, there's no dopamine release because there's no mismatch. It's exactly what you expected. But what happens with drugs is they pharmacologically release the dopamine. So the brain gets the message every time that this was actually better than expected. And so it builds up this drive to use the drug based on the physiological signals that the brain is getting that mismatch what that neurotransmitter is actually set up to do in the body. And that's a bit of an oversimplification because it doesn't work out quite that cleanly, but that does seem to be part of what drives sort of an overlearning to pursue the drug, especially in response to the cues. So that's one of the things that, people ask a lot, and that's my answer to it usually.
And with that, you know, I had a friend in high school who moved away and got addicted to meth. And he has been sober now, I'd say probably like 8, 9 years. And I asked, you know, how did you do it? And he said, well, my husband and I moved. We moved away. And that was, I'm like, well, how did that help? He said, well, we moved away from the people that we hung out with who also did it. And we could not stay. We knew that if we stayed there, we wouldn't be able to break those patterns, whether Friday, Saturday night, that would lead to, okay, well, now I'm going to be out of work for a week because I'm going down that rabbit hole. And I said, well, what would happen if you were walking down the street and you saw those people? And he goes, I would cross the street and act like I didn't see them. And it just, that was amazing to me because I heard you talk about different things that triggers it. And it's that.
And that would be hard. That would be very hard for him to
Oh,
cross pretend that he didn't see them.
that
And he may not be right that he would do that.
he wait.
It's
Well, yeah, you're probably.
that's that I mean that is that's what yeah, there's sort of three things that trigger relapses in people who've been off for a good long time. And one of the big ones is the cues associated with it. So the people, places, and things. So you get back in a situation and it starts to trigger that drive, and it's very, very hard to break that. Second one is a taste of the drug. So somebody slips you a little something, or you think, oh, just a sip or whatever. And that tends to send people right off to the races again. And then the third is stress. So anything that's stressful will often, revive those drives to use the drugs. But that's very, that is a well-known phenomenon. You might have, heard stories from, Vietnam War era. I'm old enough to remember some of that stuff. The GIs were, the troops were getting involved with opiates in Vietnam, and they were really concerned that coming back to this country, there's going to be a huge problem with opiate use in the veterans. And it didn't turn out to be so bad. And one of the reasons they think is that they came back to a totally different environment. They were not confronted with the cues that they were associated with it. And there's anecdotal reports of troops who went, had this problem, came home, had a great life, went back 20 years later to visit Vietnam and went straight back to drug use
Oh
while they were
my gosh.
there. While they were there. 20 years later, those cues set them off right back down that same pattern.
I had read and heard from a friend whose son had an addiction, and she went to Al-Anon. And she said, the interesting thing we hear about overdoses, and it's like from somebody who has been sober for, let's say, 3 years, and they fall off the wagon, that, and I'm going to use alcohol as the example, but when somebody drinks, let's say, a case of beer a day, they stop, and then 3 years later, they whether it's 3 months, 3 years, 30 years, they go back to drinking, they fall off the wagon. They don't start with one beer, they start with the case of beer. And that's a lot of times, especially with heavy drugs, that their body now is not accustomed to taking whatever it is. And is that true, doctor?
That tends to be a little less of a problem with alcohol because there's a couple things there. A lot of people who do get into trouble with alcohol have naturally higher tolerance anyway. So that case of beer, I mean, a case is a lot. That probably should do something to anybody. But the other thing is when you're drinking alcohol, you're a little more the onset of the effects is a little more tied to what you're doing. So if you're titrating to an effect, it's harder to get into real trouble with it that way. Where you really see this is with the opiates.
That's what I
People
should have said. It was like
generally,
heroin or, yeah.
people are generally injecting those, and so they don't. You it's already in your body before you know what it's going to feel like. And when you lose the tolerance, Natural tolerance levels to opiates don't really, that's not so much a thing that, that definitely varies with alcohol, but I don't think it's, I haven't seen data that it varies a lot with opiates. So they lost their tolerance and go back and inject what they think was just a normal dose, and that's where they get in trouble with overdoses.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. Heartbreaking. More
It
with the
really
doctor,
is.
and when we come back, we're going to find out how psychiatry can help people living with addiction. That's next on Advancing the Science of Addiction.
This episode of Advancing the Science of Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
Advancing the Science of Addiction is back. My name is Jimmy Alexander. Thank you so much for spending part of your day with us here. We have Betty Jo Salmeron. She's with NIDA, and she's going to tell us a doctor, a psychiatrist, and folks who are living with addiction, can they find some solace? Can they find help? And what benefits do they get from seeing a psychiatrist?
So yeah, we definitely need better treatments, but it is worth seeking treatment now. And this, this is an area that's evolved over the years quite a lot. One of the things that tends to happen with folks who are having addiction problems is they tend to develop a lot of other problems like anxiety problems and depression problems and stuff like that. And sometimes it can be hard to tell what came first. And when I was training, so this is a long time ago, we were actually trained to treat the addiction first, because the depression is probably because of the drugs. It's probably because of the effects of the drugs. So treat the addiction, and then the depression might just evaporate. If it doesn't evaporate, then you treat the depression separately. That's no longer the way we approach it. We understand better now that even if the addiction is causing or worsening the other illnesses, you need to treat both at the same time. And that's where you get get better results. So seeing a psychiatrist would help to kind of sort out what all problems are going on, because they're usually much more attuned to identifying the other comorbidities, we call them, other disorders that people might have along with the addiction, like I said, you need to address both. And unfortunately for cocaine right now, we don't have anything that's approved to help with it. There have been a number of trials with different sorts of approaches, and it does look like some of these things help some people. So there are clinicians who will use various medications off-label to see if they can get a response with people. But it's a good treatment program is going to be a combination of therapy and looking for some medications that might help, as well as just sort of case management sort of stuff, just helping people with their lives, helping people to get, helping people to get and keep a job, helping people to get and keep housing, because all of those things make a big difference in outcomes. You need a reasonably stable environment to be able to kick the habit.
And it's expensive, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
And I'm just talking about from my knowledge from watching Miami Vice back in the 80s. It always seemed like cocaine was very expensive. But it is. And so if you're not working and you have no income coming in, how are you affording, cocaine? I would imagine that that's a terrible cycle.
Yeah, it is. And that's where you get into, other criminal activities and things that are engaged in to fuel the addiction. So yeah, it sets up really, really bad cycles.
Well,
this stuff.
You hear a lot now about heroin and opioids more than you do cocaine now, but it's still, and I don't know if I've told the story here. I was at this party, and I will be the first to admit I'm not a drug person. Now, I like bourbon. It's just not one of my issues. And so we're leaving this party. It was really late. I mean, the sun is coming up, and a friend says, "Hey, are you coming tonight to the party?" And I'm like, "Oh no, it's Sunday night. I get up at 3:45 in the morning." And he looked at me and he said, "Well, you can do some coke." I'm like,
yeah.
"What?" I'm like, "Unless they have the coke, I don't even drink coke, regular coke. So unless they have the Coke Zero version of this, I know. And it, but he said it to me like he was saying, well, just if you have a headache, take some Advil.
Yeah.
And it was just like, well, that's not really one of the bad. He said this. I said, are you really do that? And he goes, well, it's not really one of the bad ones. I'm like, I think it's not a good one. And it, does it surprise you, that attitude that people still have? Some people
that doesn't surprise me. Because you know that will work short term. It's with, you know, cocaine is basically, it's very, very similar to Ritalin that we use to treat ADHD. And so it does have some alerting and focusing effects. I would absolutely not recommend it to overcome a sleep deprivation, but people do engage in that sort of behavior with some limited success. It's not a long-term winning strategy by any means.
No. Well, it's known as one of the party drugs.
Yeah.
And as my friend mentioned, and it's funny you mention Ritalin, because I may not surprise you from talking to me. I have ADHD, and I take Adderall. And it's funny, different people's attitude, because I watch somebody go, oh, well, this is how you're supposed to do Adderall. And he took his and smashed it and snorted it. I'm like, are you out of your mind? Like, I use it every day. Thank God I have it. And I've never thought to do that. And it doesn't. And I don't understand, like, oh, you go party. And I'm like, what? Like, no, I have to use it to function.
Yeah. So a lot of that has to do with the way you take the drug. It has different effects based on how quickly it gets into your system. And so, yeah, so taking an Adderall, it gets into your system kind of slowly, and it's not a huge dose, and that will help someone with ADHD very much, to help them. ADHD is one of the most rewarding psychiatric issues to treat, because most of the people get much, much better very easily and quickly. But then you can take that same drug and you can do exactly that. You can crush it, and sometimes people will even dissolve it and inject it, which is even worse. But yeah, you could snort it, and then, you know, it gets into the blood system through the nasal membranes there, and it's straight up into the brain. So it's a lot quicker, and so you can get a high very much like a cocaine high from doing that. You get about the same problems.
Do you mind from people who maybe you're listening and you know already, but for those who don't, doctor, tell us some hard facts, what cocaine does to the body and long-term effects of doing this drug.
Yeah. So a lot of the really bad effects are right away. And again, it matters a whole lot how quick things get into your system. The body can accommodate a lot of changes if they're happening slowly. If they're happening fast, it's a lot worse. And so all, you know, the cocaine and the amphetamine, the Adderall and all that sort of stuff, they're all stimulants. And so what they do is kind of pump the body up. So the heart rate goes up, the blood pressure goes up. They're vasoconstrictors, so the blood vessels sort of clamp down. And that's where a lot of the problems come into play, because the tissues all over the body, brain, heart, lungs, they're not getting the blood supply they need because of this vasoconstriction. And so that can lead to heart attacks. It can lead to strokes. It can lead to all sorts of problems. And when you, even if it doesn't, those would be the acute, really bad problems. But just subjecting your body to that over and over again will lead to, you know, small little problems and, you know, little bits of, you know, mini infarcts in the brain and things that start to pile up and cause problems long term. A lot of the, we know it's got some, you know, it's got definitely got some detrimental cardiovascular effects long term. And, you know, if you're smoking it, you know, smoking the crack, you know, your lungs don't really like anything other than air being put in there. And they can handle a lot of things. But, you know, smoking drugs is just not a great idea. It's not doesn't make your lungs happy. So long-term effects, that gets a little bit dicier, because the way we determine some of these things is we'll take a cohort of cocaine users and a cohort of normal people that are otherwise about the same, and we'll compare them on a bunch of neuropsychological tests or, you know, questionnaires of different sorts of functions and things. And if we see differences, the temptation is to say, that's because they've been using cocaine. And that might be the case. It might also be the case that those differences you're seeing are differences that pre-existed their cocaine use and predisposed them to being developing a problem with it. And for a lot of things, especially the things like, you see more impulsivity in cocaine users and a little more cognitive problems, cognitive flexibility sorts of problems. And it seems like those are a lot often a combination of both. Some pre-existing, some worsening with the drug use.
How addictive is cocaine?
So it does depend on things like the route you take it and things like that. Probably depends a bit on the age at which you're starting it too, which is definitely an issue for things like alcohol and marijuana. But it's on the order of somewhere between 10 and 20%, probably around 15 to 20% of people who try it will develop a problem with it. If you try it, I've heard this from a lot of people who used it too. They snorted it for a long time, enjoyed it, never got in trouble with it. The first time they tried crack, which is a faster route to the brain, they were addicted and they were in trouble immediately, is the way they will describe it. After a long-term usage of snorted cocaine. And if you look, the countries where this stuff is coming from down in South America, it's used like a tea. And people are not getting into huge problems with it. It used to be in Coca-Cola. That's where the name came from. It had cocaine in it. And it didn't cause huge problems. Didn't cause no problems, but it didn't cause huge problems consuming it that way. But the faster the route, so that's going to be your smoked and your IV things, the more likely you are to get into trouble with it.
That is just amazing to hear. Think of when that long ago that Coke was invented and cocaine was in Coke, or as you just said, where it got its name. And then we fast forward to crack, where it's made in with made by chemists, right?
Yeah,
Yeah,
basically, yeah.
which is
It,
quite
yeah,
different
turned
than
into a.
the pseudo more natural
Well,
cocaine.
it still comes from the cocaine. They kind of
Yeah.
transform it into a different, the different something closer to the freebase version sort of thing that
Well,
just gets in a lot quicker.
Doctor, what treatments are you all working on for cocaine addiction?
This is an area that's been a lot of fun. One of the things we've been able to get into is a technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS. People might have seen advertisements for it as a depression treatment. It's approved for depression and obsessive compulsive disorder and a few other things. There's actually a nicotine approval for it now. But what this does is allows us to non-invasively stimulate a particular part of the brain. And so what we've done for most of my career is put people in the scanner and show them cues or inject some drug or have them do a cognitive task and look and see what's different in the brain or what parts of the brain are involved in the various responses that are part of the addictive cycle. And every paper ends with something like, and these results might help us someday to develop better treatments for cocaine use disorder. And it's sort of a throwaway line that, yeah, we hope it will. But with the advent of TMS, we actually now have a way to target particular parts of the brain and alter their functioning a bit. And so that's been really intriguing. So we've been playing with transcranial magnetic stimulation as an intervention for cocaine use disorder. The study right now is actually not proceeding, but we've had some preliminary results that are extremely promising, and it's been invested. People are actually in Italy just sort of starting to use it clinically, with some really good results. And so the idea with this is we know, the front part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, is involved in kind of controlling our behaviors, exerting what we call executive control. Most of what we do is sort of done pretty much reflexively. But we can sort of think about what we're doing and exert some control over things, patterns that are going in the wrong direction. And so what we do with the TMS is we stimulate this area and we do that over and over again, and it seems to kind of strengthen it. And that's the report we're getting. We did a pilot study with this to just see if it was feasible and if people tolerated okay. And so for that one, we recruited folks with cocaine addictions, who they couldn't be actually interested in treatment because this wasn't a treatment study, but they also couldn't be. We had to let them know this might change your relationship to cocaine. Would that bother you? So if they really wanted to continue with their use, then they shouldn't enroll in this study. And it was basically, like I said before, all of them said, "Oh, really? Yeah, I don't want a treatment referral, but yeah, this might, I wouldn't be upset with that at all." No. And so we got people who were, pretty long-term heavy users. And, one person came into the study expressly to get a negative urine because she had a chance to get a job. And she hadn't had a good, hadn't been able to hold a job in a long time. And it's a 2 week treatment. By the end of, it took her into the second week to get a negative urine. And she was telling us, I do feel a little different. Maybe I'll cut back a little. Maybe. She got the job. She did resume using. We knew that before she was totally out of the follow-up period. But she said, it didn't feel as good. I still enjoyed it, but didn't feel as good. But I also didn't feel like I had to. And so, okay, well, that sounds cool. So she went off, and we just ran into her a year later. And this was someone who was had been using 5 to 7 times a week. And she said she still had her job. She was enjoying the job, had held it for a year now, and she did still use just on Friday nights, just $30. Never blew her whole paycheck on it. And if the grandkids wanted to do something that Friday night, she'd skip that week.
Oh, well, I mean,
That, in my mind, is a cure.
yes, it just hurts your heart to hear that this woman has grandkids and that this has been
Yeah.
battling for such a long time.
Yeah.
But
Yeah.
she's held that job and she's been able to go from 5 to 7 times a week to once. That's pretty impressive.
Once and controlling the amount. So remember, usually that taste of it, people are off to the races. And she was limiting it to $30 on a Friday night, that's it. And if she had an alternative, that's another one of our criteria for dependence. You're passing up other options to do the drug. And she was doing exact opposite.
Well, that had to
If the
make you.
grandkids wanted to do something, she'd drop the drug and go do something with the
That
grandkids.
has to make you feel good. It has to make
Very
you feel
good.
sad.
Yes.
Now,
Yes.
if somebody is listening, and so it's either them or somebody in their lives that has an addiction, where can they go to find out more about treatment centers in their area?
So our partners over at SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, they have a very good treatment referral database. So you can find that at findtreatment.gov, all one word. And it'll take you to a SAMHSA website that you can just put in your zip code and tell them what you're looking for, and they'll find you clinics to contact.
And with that, how can people find out more about what you guys are doing and maybe be part of a research study at NIDA-IRP?
Yeah, sure. There's a number of ways to do that. Probably the easiest thing is just to just Google NIDA IRP, and that will bring you to our website that has a research tab, research volunteers tab. You can also just directly go to researchstudies.nida.nih.gov, which is a little longer too.
But you'll get right there. And do you mind if I ask you a couple more questions? Because we're running tight on time. But I just, if somebody, and I always think about somebody's kid, if you found out, if somebody came to you and said, hey, my daughter, son, or me, they're addicted to cocaine, they had a cocaine problem. What are a couple steps that they should take immediately?
Understanding that you have a problem is a huge first step. And then looking for a treatment center to interact with, looking for some of the self-help groups. Narcotics Anonymous can be very helpful to some people. Looking for anywhere that you can find support. And so help, any good treatment will involve the family also. So you need to identify the people in your environment who can be a support to you as you go through this process.
And I know not shaming that person in your life is also
Oh,
very.
absolutely. Yeah, this can sneak up on anybody. There are very few people who have not tried some addictive substance in their lives. There are some, but there are very few. And if you have tried it, you're at risk.
What would you say the current landscape of addiction crisis and what should the community understand about addiction?
I think the first thing is trying to destigmatize it and understand it as a disorder. And it's very hard to tell who's going to be vulnerable. And so if you tried something and you're gotten away with it, don't feel like you're better than the person next to you who tried it and got into trouble with it. It can happen to anybody. And so I, you know, these days, in Baltimore especially, probably our biggest problem is with the opiates that are now pretty much entirely transitioned to just fentanyl. And fentanyl is a very powerful opiate, so it's very easy to take too much by accident, basically. And so what we're hearing is that a lot of the addicts, the people who have problems with the opiates actually like it now because it does give them a stronger high, but it's much more dangerous, much easier to accidentally overdose on it than on some of the other variations of opiates. And so a lot of things that we're doing, with that is, trying to get the educational outreach out there. The Narcan does reverse it temporarily. You need to get that person help right away too, because that reversal is probably not going to outlast the effects of the drug. So they'll need another reversal in 15 or 20 minutes, if they're suffering from an overdose. But yeah, so trying to get the word out about the dangers of these things, and that there are treatment approaches available. And just trying to reduce the stigma that, yeah, no, I mean, this happens. Very few of us have not put ourselves at risk for a substance use problem. And it is the minority who actually develop the substance use problem, but it's a physical problem at that point. It's not a sign of weakness or,
No. Well, you hear the stories, these kids in the bathrooms at their school, and it's just heartbreaking. And
it
then,
is. Yeah.
because we think so often, or I do, the kids today, they're with the issues. But to hear, as you just mentioned, the grandmother who's, and God bless her that she's doing much better, much, much, much better. But hearing that this disease has affected a majority of her life is just so heartbreaking. And luckily, we have people like you guys over at NIDA IRP doing what you can to
We're trying.
understand better. So thank you. And thank you for sharing your day with us here today, Doctor.
Thanks for having me.
We
Good
appreciate
talking.
it. And thank you for tuning in to Advancing the Science of Addiction, brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. And join us next time for another insightful episode. Until then, stay informed and take care.